One of the amazing things about the Sabbath for me is to have the opportunity to cease from all regular activity. Even though I'm quite busy oftentimes on the Sabbath, it's not the same as the rest of the week, and I appreciate that time. And especially this time of year when winter has relented its grip, I enjoy the Sabbath even more because I can sit and enjoy God's creation. Even during the week, if I need a break, I come out of my office, I stand by the back slider, and I can look at the birds and the animals in our backyard, and it really brings a sense of wonder. And that's one of the reasons why we chose to live where we do. Many of you have been to our home. There's a exposure there. There's a beauty to God's creation that we have from our house that I really appreciate. And I've lost track of the number of pictures I've taken of sunsets from our backyard. The way, for whatever reason, where we're situated, we just get beautiful sunsets. And depending on the year and the season, we can have all manner of number of animals crossing through our backyard. We don't see these all the time and every year, but fox and pheasant and snapping turtles, those seem to be a perennial. And I'm never surprised at how much they stink. Rabbits, and we get frustrated with the rabbits. They seem to want to taste things and not eat them. So they'll eat halfway through a tulip, and it's like, just eat the whole thing. Don't just kill it. We even get river otters. I didn't even know those existed until I came to Wisconsin. And boy, can they clean a pond out of the fish real fast. All manner of birds, as I mentioned, but beyond the songbirds, cranes, we have the cranes that nest in the conservancy behind us. Hawks, kingfisher, egrets, all manner of birds of that type. And in addition to that, this time of year is wonderful. We're finally able to see things back in bloom, the flowering plants, the bushes, the trees. And there's something about, Roxanne and I have made this comment a number of times this year. I don't know if it's because we had a milder winter or what the situations were, but all of our plants are huge this year. The hostas are just, and I divide those on a regular basis and spread them around the yard, but they're just monstrous this year. Our lilac bushes, there's two of them next to each other, they're so covered with blooms it looks like there's snow on them. They're just thick. But it's relaxing for me to sit on our patio and listen to the birds singing, watch them flying between the bushes and the trees, hear the bees moving about, watch the butterflies and the moths, and even the hummingbirds gathering nectar. What to me is also truly amazing is that there's always enough in God's creation to take care of them. And we read that, and we'll go to that here in a moment. But today we're going to consider God's creation and what we are to learn in trusting and obeying God. Mr. Warner Schmidt turned to Matthew 6. I want to turn there as well, come at it from a little bit different perspective than he did. But we live in such, as he mentioned, a frantic, hectic, fast-paced culture that we can forget a perspective that is absolutely necessary for not only us, but for all of mankind to remember. And we read of this here in Matthew 6. I want to pick up in verse 26. Christ, again speaking, says, "Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they?" And as I mentioned, they're always taken care of. They always have enough. Verse 27, "Which of you by worrying can add one cubit to a stature? So why do you worry about clothing?" And look at what we worry about in the world around us. So much of the energy we put into life is for things, it seems. And we have to be careful of that perspective. He says, "Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin." You know, some of this to me is just amazing how God has shaped the physical world around us and how it operates. You know, even the flowers, how do they know when to bloom? There's an element of light. It has to be enough length of day. There's an element of heat, and you can trick flowers into blooming earlier. You can force a bulb. But nonetheless, how does that bulb know? When it gets that information, when it feels the heat, when it feels the light, no one knows. Verse 29, then he says, "Yet I say to you that even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these." Militant environmentalists, animal rights activists have rejected this perspective that God will take care of us, that we're better than the animals, better from God's perspective for a different reason. And they say that mankind is not more valuable than the rest of creation. In fact, many of them will say nature is more important. So we see this in some of these actions. We see it in perspectives of philosophies. For instance, in evolution, if we're just viewed as a higher animal, then other animals have equal rights, if you will. And there was a state this past week, I should have made note of it more, but there was someone that brought a lawsuit because a fellow's neighbor had a couple of chimpanzees, I guess, as pets. And this neighbor didn't like this. And so he filed suit saying these chimpanzees were being unlawfully detained. And he actually took them to court, and it went fairly high up, and the judge saw the foolishness of it and dismissed the charge or the suit. But nonetheless, I wouldn't be surprised if down the road this isn't something made higher or made more headway. Let's turn next to Hebrews chapter 2. And the question is asked here by the writer, probably Paul, but he's quoting from a section of Psalm. And he asks a question, and it's not just a question. The way the question is asked is it's meant to inspire reflection. It's not simply looking for information back. It's looking to provoke insight, if you will. So Hebrews 2 and verse 6. But one testified in a certain place saying, "What is man that you are mindful of him? Why did God make mankind?" This is a question almost all of mankind has no answer to. Now, you have different philosophies, you have different religions, you have different perspectives of things that think they understand, but that's a major question, isn't it? Why do we exist? Or what is the Son of Man that you take care of him? And again, even as was reflected in the sermonette, we can easily forget how much God does take care of us. We have to put work into things. And rightly so. God is not just going to give us everything. That's not a healthy perspective. But oftentimes in our work, then, we think we have accomplished this. This is what got Nebuchadnezzar into trouble, right? Look at what I have created. Verse 7, you have made him a little lower than the angels. And some translations say you've temporarily made him lower. You have crowned him with glory and honor. You know, we have abilities the rest of the creation does not. We have the ability to think in time. We have the ability to make, to create things on a level that other animals cannot. We can express a wide range of emotions that animals cannot. We even have language, complex language. We have this glory that God has given us. We're set apart from the rest of nature. The rest of verse 7, set him over the works of your hand. We have dominion over the land. If you go back to Genesis, God gave mankind that dominion. Verse 8, you have put all things in subjection under his feet. So the question remains, what is man? And I mentioned this was from Psalms. This is Psalm 8, verse 4. And it's, again, meant to engender a reflection here, especially in light of what we read in Matthew 6. What is man compared to the rest of creation? Why are we so different? And even here, as it says, that you care for him. You know, why does mankind have the attention of God? What's so different, special about us? We're going to come to that a little bit more, but I'm going to transition into some other thoughts here. The book of Job is an amazing book, in my mind, because we have such an intimate look and into a person's life. There's no other book like it in Scripture. It's also an interesting book because we have a behind-the-scenes glimpse of how Satan behaves and what God seeks in a person. We see the interaction, especially initially in the book of Job, of that interaction between God and Satan, and the differences of viewpoints, if you will. Most think that in the book of Job, God was correcting Job for some egregious sin, and many will say self-righteousness. The self-righteousness actually came a bit later because of Job's frustrations, but God didn't have the perspective that Job had a problem up front because of what he said to Satan. He said to Satan that Job was blameless. If that was not a true statement, do you think Satan would have let that go? And yet Satan deflects it. He says, well, but he's that way because you give him this and you give him that. And if you take it all away, he'll just curse you. And so God allows Satan to take everything from Job except his life and the life of his wife. He lost his family, his children. He lost his servants. He lost his wealth. He lost everything. Even his health was compromised. And the majority of the balance of the book, then, is a conversation between Job and his friends. And initially, his friends are very supportive, but they quickly decide that Job is hiding some egregious sin, and that if he would just admit to this sin, that God would restore him. And Job gets very frustrated. This is where this frustration comes in, because Job knows what he has done before God. And the only voice of reason comes along a little bit later in the form of the younger friend, Elihu. But Elihu sees a problem that the others don't. He sees Job's defensiveness and his self-justification before God. And he tries to show Job that all of this is not helpful in coming to a deeper understanding of God and his purpose. As I mentioned, Elihu seems to see this. And so you have recorded in Job 32 to 37 Elihu's responses. And we will not read all of those today, but it's very enlightening. The insight, this younger man, he even says, you know, who am I? I'm not one of age that has this wisdom, and yet God seemed to give him an insight the others did not have. And so then by the end of chapter 37, Job finally runs out of words. He's tired physically, he's probably tired mentally, and he finally just goes quiet. And once that happens, then God speaks up. God has not spoken to Job yet to this point. And at the beginning of chapter 38, he does. And it says, "The Eternal answered Job out of the whirlwind, and he said..." So he begins to ask Job here a series of questions. He says, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge?" And this is something we have to be careful of as well. Mankind certainly is guilty of this. We think we know so much, and yet even when it comes to the natural world, as I mentioned, we don't really have a clue how these things work. How does a tree know when to start running sap in the spring? If it's too early, it'll freeze. If it's not early enough, there are problems in the tree's growth. If the sap is not strong enough, how does it know when to bud its leaves? And each tree is different. We have several willows I've planted around our property because we have such wet spots. The willow trees are some of the last to lose their leaves and some of the last to gain them in the spring, at least in my area. How do they know when they should leaf out? God's asking some very pointed questions here of Job. So now he says, verse 3, "Prepare yourself like a man." Okay, so if you're going to stand up here and you're going to make these accusations, and if you're going to defend yourself so verisively, he says, "then I'm going to ask you some questions." He says, "I will question you and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Explain to me how that took place, Job. Did I do it right? How does it come together?" You know, the earth is a very fascinating thing. We have atmosphere, thankfully. We can breathe a mixture of various gases. We call it oxygen. It's not pure oxygen. But we have an atmosphere mostly because we have a molten core. Molten core of iron. Because we have that molten core of iron, basically, as the earth rotates, we create a magnetic field. And that magnetic field creates gravity and it helps hold things to the surface of the earth. Otherwise, we would look like Mars or many other planets that have nothing. How does that all work? How does magnetism even work? Find yourself, I don't know, we may have a few here, find yourself an electrical engineer and ask him what electricity is. We know enough to know how to harness some of it. We really don't have a clue what it is. It functions as water at times. It sort of has similar principles in the way it flows, but it has other principles that go against that. Why does it work that way? How is it even created? End of verse 4, he says, "Tell me if you have understanding, who determined the measurements of the earth? Why is it the size that it is? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? What was its foundations fastened to? Who laid the cornerstone?" You know, in building up until modern era, everything, most any major edifice was stone. And that cornerstone was primary importance because it had to be perfectly level, it had to be perfectly square, because everything came off that corner. So if that corner was not right, then the building was not right. God's asked the question. Who laid the cornerstone? Where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Perhaps this is an allusion to other spots where it talks about they sang with joy when they saw the creation of the earth. He said, I don't remember you being in that group. Who shut the seas with its doors when it burst forth and issued from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment, thick and dark in a swaddling band, when I fixed my limit for it and set bars and doors, why does the ocean stop where it does? Why doesn't it go other places? So he's asking these questions here, and Job, to his credit, just remains silent. He doesn't have any answers. You know, how does it that we can have a concern of hitting deer all year long, come hunting season, you couldn't find a deer to save your life? How do they know? They know. Even some of the animals, it's pretty interesting. You know, various birds that will nest in various areas, and some of them nest fairly close to the house. There's a robin that's probably pretty irritated at us because we've got a small arbor next to the garage that we've got climbing roses on. And she found a spot up in the arbor. She built a nest. So every time one of us walks through that arbor, she's irritated. She flies off and she's chirping at us nonstop. She's not happy. The little birds in the nest don't make a sound. But if you look up there, they're attentive, their mouth is open, they're waiting for mom to come back and feed them. How do they know not to make a sound? God goes on here to explain about other things. Have you entered, verse 16, the springs of the sea? This was not known even to the modern era. Have you walked in search of the depths? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? You know, we don't understand these things. We know that death is a part of life. But look at how many different viewpoints there are as to what death is or what it means. Verse 19, where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place? You know, again, light is another one of those things. We really don't understand. This past couple of weeks, I forget what it was, scientists confirmed a part of Einstein's theory of relativity that a strong enough gravitational pull, say of a star, can actually bend light. We don't think of things like that. How did they confirm that? Well, they, with the Hubble telescope, many other sophisticated pieces of equipment they have now, they can actually measure these things. And what will happen is a star will look to be in a different spot because the light has bent. It's actually behind something that you're seeing. How do you explain that? You can bend light. You can also slow it down. We tend to think of light being constant speed, but we don't know these things. God does, obviously. He made them. Verse 22, have you entered the treasury of the snow? Have you seen the treasury of hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, day of battle and war? You know, how do these things come about? Look at how much of a guessing game it is for meteorologists. In spite of the sophisticated technology they have, the satellites that they have, all the modeling software they have, and they can't even get it right a day out, you know, because there's so much happening there. But how do you make snow? I mean, you can make it physically, but they don't really understand the process of it. He talks at one point about the oxen. Verse 39, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? You know, how do the animals know when to bear their young? Why is it that it only happens that time, one time a year? Can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months they fulfill? Do you know the time when they bear their young? So he asks these questions. You know, we look at the world around us, and it's a truly amazing place when you look at the creation. You know, and you look at somebody like Richard Attenborough, who has traveled the world looking at these amazing things, and they chalk it off to nature and evolution, and it just doesn't answer the questions. Verse 9 is the one about the ox. Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? You know, that animal is huge. If you've ever been around oxen, they're huge. And they're some of the most docile creatures in the world. They're strong as all get out. They're an interesting animal. I think God actually created some animals specifically to serve us. Oxen's one of them. I think horses are another. But we still don't understand these things. Will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Or will he leave your labor to him? What about verse 13? Wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but her wings are pinions like kindly storks. You know, some of these creatures are truly astounding. You ever seen a camel run? You talk about something that looks goofy. They are so ungangly. And some of it is because their front legs bend differently than their back legs. So when they run, it's very awkward. But when you think about it, it does make a lot of sense for the environment God designed them for. Their feet are huge pads. If they were hooves, they'd sink in the sand. It'd burn their feet to begin with. Their eyes are designed to shield out sand, the eyelids and the eyelashes. But those legs bend differently, so it's easier for them to get up and down, almost like a scissor movement. But notice verse 14, she leaves her eggs on the ground. That doesn't seem like a very wise thing to do. They're very vulnerable, as it says there. She leaves them in the dust, forgets that a foot may crush them or that wild beasts may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. But notice, this is verse 17, because God deprived her of wisdom, did not endow her with understanding. Verse 19, have you given the horse its strength? You've clothed its neck with thunder. You know, so God asks these questions, and as you have opportunity, maybe you don't have the opportunity I do, to watch some of the animals, the wild animals in the world that God has placed out there, but they're amazing to watch. Whether you watch them on documentaries or you see these animals in zoo and you consider and ponder them, you know, how do they know how to do these things? You know, I mentioned the snapping turtles because we're in such a wet area. They love the ponds. They love those deep areas. And a really interesting thing is that they do not lay their eggs in the area they live. They find a high spot, which is a very curious thing to do. How do they know? How do they know where to head? Well, in our area, that means our flower beds. So oftentimes, we find them having dug and planted in there. And sometimes we don't. A couple of years ago, we didn't even know they had placed their eggs in one of our flower beds until Roxanne saw a whole troop of these little baby snapping turtles heading back to the pond. But again, how did they know where to go for water? They're very vulnerable, and it was not a short trek. How do they know these things? I mentioned the deer and the hunters, the songbirds. Have you ever seen a songbird harass a hawk? That's pretty funny to watch. Here's this hawk, could take him out with one grab of his talons. And yet they will, if that hawk gets too close to their nest, they will harass that hawk and harass him. And I've watched them fly for miles harassing a hawk out of their area. And yet to watch something like a hawk or a falcon hunt other birds is truly awesome. The speed and the devastation they can do in the way they hunt. But even going back to the songbirds, the number of different nests that they'll build, and it's amazing the material that they'll use and how they use it. How can you make such a soft nest out of things like twigs? You know, but they find leaves, they find moss, they pull out in some cases their own down feathers, and they coat these nests. Now, I'm always amazed at the hummingbirds. You've got such a small bird, and how fast they can move. Do you know how a hummingbird drinks nectar from a flower? Scientists don't either. For a long time, they thought that the tongue was basically like a straw and that they would just simply suck the nectar up, but they realized that if the sugar concentration was higher than about 40%, you can't do that. The viscosity, it's too thick. So how do they do it? Well, they finally put high-speed video to it, and they discovered that the tongue actually has a series of tubes on it, mostly along the side of the tongue that will open up, and so then they sort of draw it in. Because of that, the design of that tongue then, they can also use or select higher concentration sugar, nectar. So that explains that part of it, but they still don't know how they swallow. Once you draw all that in, how do you swallow it? How do seals find their prey in murky water? if it's clear water, it's fine, but it's not always clear. You know, tides can stir up sediment and storms and so forth. And working with seals that were trained for this experiment, scientists discovered that they could distinguish what shape of a paddle was made in the water when it was moved through it. The seal could determine that. So how do they determine that? Well, further experimentation, what they found out was that the whiskers on seals and other similar ones like walruses and whatnot, that they are so sensitive that they can actually detect the eddies in the water, and they can paint a picture of what created that. So in murky water, they can actually follow the fish as it swims through the water. Very similar to how dolphins use their sonar. Seals will use their whiskers. One maybe a little closer to home. Some of you I know have dogs. What's the process a dog uses to drink? For a long time, people thought the dog would turn its tongue and make sort of a cup and sort of lap it in. But again, using video, they realized that's not what's happening. Actually, what's happening is the tongue is creating its own surface tension with the water, and it's actually pulling the water into the mouth. The problem is dogs are pretty sloppy when they do it. So they create a mess. But cats actually use the same process. But being cats, they're a little more fastidious about it, and they're not as messy. But that surface tension, again, with water, that's a whole other topic. Job 40 in verse 3. After God asks in these two chapters here, he asks Job all these questions, and he says, okay, explain these things to me. And, of course, Job can't. And Job simply answers in two verses. Verse 3, Job answers. Verse 4, he says, behold, I am vile. He says, I don't know. And as I said today after I gave this in Oshkosh, how many times can you say, I don't know? He had to say it a lot. He says, what shall I answer to you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, and I will proceed no further. He realized that he was out of his element. He was way over his head here. The charges he had laid against God didn't hold anything. But God wasn't done teaching Job here. And modern man becomes so ignorant in their knowledge. What do I mean by that? Well, look at where we've progressed in the last couple of hundred years. My grandfather, and I'm sure some of your relatives as well, my grandfather was born in the early part of the 1900s, 1901. He literally went from horse and buggy to the nuclear space age. You think of everything that changed during that time. And we can think, well, you know, we're not moving at such a fast pace, but we are. Especially with computer technology, one of the real serious concerns of scientists is that as artificial intelligence advances, what will that mean for mankind? And you say, well, that's still off in the future. No, it's not. Most auto manufacturers now are saying that by roughly around 2025, we will have self-driving autonomous cars. You will not have to drive. You will get in, you will tell it where you want to go, and it will drive you. Now, we have that now, actually. Google and many other companies have been working on this. The problem is the people who are still driving the cars because they do stupid stuff. Can you imagine? They change lanes without looking. I saw that yesterday again. A guy cut off a delivery truck, on the other lane was a semi, and I thought if that delivery truck had kept going, he would have been sandwiched between the two. He didn't care. He was going to go where he was going. So these automated cars can't anticipate the stupidity of humanity fast enough to adapt for it. You know, people run lights, they change lanes without warning, doing all these silly things. It's there. We'll use it eventually. But we think we know so much, and we've only begun to scratch the surface, just not even completely scratch it, just beginning to. What we know is impressive, certainly. We've been able to harness some amazing things that God has created. But even there, in the human body, we don't understand it. Doctors don't. God has established his creation with such intricacy, but also amazingly with such simplicity and beauty. Let's go to Mark chapter 2. God has a special purpose for mankind. And the creation was meant to be a support. God also extended to mankind something that he has not given the rest of the created world, and that is this Sabbath day. Christ mentions this here in Mark 2 and verse 27. He said to them, because the Pharisees specifically, they had gotten off track. They began to worship the Sabbath and not who made the Sabbath. They had begun to lay a level of righteousness in the regulations that they had for the Sabbath day, and they were making it onerous. They were making it a burden. They'd taken the joy out of it. And so then Christ here corrects them, and he says, the Sabbath was made for man. Sabbath is for man's benefit. The Sabbath is to serve mankind, to finish his thought, and not man for the Sabbath. It's not the other way around. That's what the Pharisees had misplaced. And in doing so, they lost not only understanding, they began to view these things as burdens. God created the Sabbath so that we would have uninterrupted time to strengthen our relationship with him. We would stop from everything that we're doing in life. We would pause and we would be able to consider these things, even like his creation, to marvel at it. Do we know what that is? Okay. As long as you know, I don't have any clue what that is. All right. He also created the creation. He created the Sabbath day so that we have a glimpse of what God has in mind for us. Going back to the verse I read earlier, you know, what is man? Hebrews 2. We should see in what God has done. And we'll look at that in Romans chapter 1. Paul, when he went to Athens, he saw this in the things that they worshiped, the various statues and the gods that they had created. But we even see this in a modern sense. I talked about the environmentalists and the animal rights activists. You know, they look at the creation and they say, no, we are not better than that. You know, in fact, these animals have more rights, they say, than man should have. But Romans 1:20, Paul is stressing here a perspective that's been lost. He said, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen. Do we see God in the creation? We should, because evolutionists really don't have the answers. They pretend as if they do. But even in their own belief, they have no mechanism for how this works, how they think it works. But notice, God's attributes are understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. God not only made all of these things, he sustains them. To answer some of the questions back in Job, the reason these animals know these things is because God continues to direct them. This would all go off the rails in a heartbeat if God decided he wasn't going to do it anymore. Because it wouldn't, who would maintain it? And so then he goes on to talk in the other verses of the consequences. We see that in the lifestyles, in the pursuits, in the various things in the world around us. But God hid, if it were, his aspects in the natural world. We should see his hand in these things. He wants us to see these things so that we understand him. There's even the verse that talks out, it is God's prerogative to hide a matter, and it's the king's matter to search it out, to find out why. You know, and there's a great story, if you've never read it, Booker T. Washington. You know, he spent a great deal of his life pursuing understanding the peanut. And you think, well, peanut, I mean, come on. But down south, that was a cash crop, and it was a great cash crop for somebody especially that was poor. So he was looking at helping his fellow man, especially in the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. The blacks in the South did not have a very good time economically, a very good road. And I forget the number of things that he developed out of peanuts. He created paint, of course, various oils. You can use it as a food product. There's just any number of things in the experiments that he did. And someone asked him about that one time. I think it goes along the line of, he said, I asked God to understand the creation, and he says, I'll give you the peanut. You know, that just study that and see what you can find out of that. And what God has done on a spiritual level is no less astounding. He has hid his plan of salvation for mankind in plain sight through observing the holy days. We know that. We know the plan of man. We can answer those questions. Why man? What is the purpose of life? What happens after death? We understand all of that because of keeping the holy days, to see what God is doing. We begin to understand his character through keeping the Ten Commandments. We see his values. We see who he is at his essence. We know his love for us as we love each other, as we put those things into practice. And we care for one another as he's told us to do so. And we should be humbled to know that such a powerful and awesome God put all of his creation into place so that you and I, the rest of mankind, could be in his family. I mean, think about that. Look at what he has created so that we will walk that path. So how does all this fit in, our calling and everything else, fit in with these different aspects of God's amazing creation? Well, let's go back to Proverbs 6. It goes back to what we covered in brief with the book of Job. God wants us to come to a deeper level of understanding and submission. That's really what he wanted from Job. God did not take delight in leading Job through that process, but, you know, sometimes we have to go through the tough parts of life in order to learn the deep lessons. And you look at what Job went through, and I'm sure it was bittersweet, because at the end of that book, God not only restored, but gave him even more, because he understood now. He had a better understanding of God. And in Proverbs 6, verse 6, the statement is made here. It says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise." Something as small and from our perspective as insignificant as an ant can teach us some of these lessons. I mean, when was the last time you thought about ants? Probably the last time they invaded your kitchen. But ants are truly amazing insects. They're not quite sure how many numbers of species there are. There are more than 15,000 identified. They believe that there are more than 22,000 species of ants. And they inhabit every land mass on Earth minus Antarctica. See, even the ants are smart. They don't live where it's cold. They form colonies. They work together. They divide up responsibilities. I'm sure many of you know this from school and whatnot. You know, there are workers, there are soldiers, there's the queen. You know, they all divide this up. They can store food. I think that's part of what's being talked about here. You know, again, God providing for his creation, going back to Matthew 6. But they can do some amazing things. Maybe you've seen some of the documentaries where they can actually build bridges across bodies of water. They'll interlink themselves, and they all seem to know what each one's doing. And they each contribute, and pretty soon they've got this living bridge, and the rest can pass over safely. They store food. Maybe you've seen, again, the documentaries with the leaf cutters, especially in the tropical areas. They don't eat the leaves. How do they know to do this? What they actually do with the leaves is they put them in their colonies, and they cultivate a special fungus that grows on the leaf. And it's the fungus that they eat. Because for them, digesting the cellulose of the plant matter is too much. And so it's the fungus that they eat. How do they know to do that? Some ants will also herd other insects or even butterfly larvae because they create a special sugary substance some call honeydew. They collect this sugar creation, and yes, they take that from the animals, if you will, but they also then protect their herd. They protect them from other predators. They protect them from other insects. They can also shape their environments. They have the ability, some ants, to kill certain plants with various toxins that they have. They do that to maximize the growth of the plants in the area they do want. They can also protect certain plants by defending it against other insects or animals. And in doing so, that plant will give them housing. They can live inside the plant. Let's go next to Isaiah 66. The complexity at which God has made all of this is truly astounding. And sometimes it's just because we're not exposed to it. We don't know it. But again, in our modern abilities with nature documentaries, most of us are familiar with a lot of these things. We can watch these. We can see how they function. But still, who designed it all? It's very empty in the world to say, well, evolution. Well, that's blind chance, but it's not blind chance. We have them look the way they work together. Isaiah 66 in verse 2, the questions are asked here. He says, for all these things my hand is made, God says, and all these things exist. Here we have a simple statement that mankind has rejected. God says, you see all of this, you know all of this, you should look into these things, he says, because I've made them. They only exist because of me. But notice, this comes back to the question I asked earlier. What is man? Why does God have a special affinity for man? He says, but on this one will I look, on him who is of a poor and a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. God can't teach the animal world like he can teach us. We have a different spirit. The Bible calls it the spirit of man. And when God places a portion of his spirit with us, then there's something there that's nowhere else in the universe. God is looking for us to develop this humble heart, this teachability. If we move over to chapter 43, Isaiah 43 and verse 10. God says here, you are my witness and my servant whom I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. This goes back to Romans 1. The world should be able to look at the creation alone and see God in that. How does it know to do what it does? All of it. And to work in perfect harmony. You know, my grandparents for, 25 or so years lived in Florida. And in Florida, one of the problems they have perennially, because it's so warm, is you have cockroaches. And some of them can get pretty big. You have to maintain a pretty clean environment so the cockroaches aren't there, but inevitably they'll get around. My grandmother found a very interesting thing, some of this information that gets passed down. How do you repel cockroaches? Well, you can use chemicals, and there are all kinds of problems. Not to say they're not effective, but she would slice up cucumbers and put them around. In the cupboards and along the floors, around the trash cans, and you think, cucumbers? I said the same thing, cucumbers? But there's something in the composition of the cucumbers that the cockroaches don't like, and they'll stay away from it. She never had a problem with cockroaches. God says, look, I have declared these things. And there's another part to this. Notice the end of verse 10. Before me there was no God formed, nor shall there be after me. In spite of what mankind thinks or hopes or desires, there is only one God. He is the one who has created it all. And as such, doesn't it stand to reason that he is the one who we should ask, how does this work? What is it that we should do? Let's go to Micah chapter 6. I got a kick out of this morning. Mr. and Mrs. Schneiderhan tend to sit up front in Oshkosh. Everybody tends to sit in the same spot. So as I said, Micah 6, and he starts reciting the minor prophets. So I could hear him because he was so close. And I said, you know what? I do the same thing. I have to go through my head. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, you know. But it's right before Nahum, so glad to help. Micah 6, verse 8. He has shown you, O man. God has not left us without answers in these questions that we have. He says, he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the eternal require of you? What is it that God wants from us? This is a short list. To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. To be able to be taught. To do justice, you need to know the law. I've talked about that in recent sermons. You have to know what the standard is. You have to know what the expectations are. You have to know what works and what doesn't work. You know, as I've mentioned in other messages, you can't put diesel fuel in a gasoline-powered engine. Won't work. Once you know the law, you also have to know mercy, because there are always exceptions, aren't there? If you're simply black and white, there is no variation. You're going to hurt people. There are times when mercy is required. And God even gives us an example of that. One such is the hypothetical, what do you do if your cow gets out on Sabbath and it gets hung up in a spot? It's in a ditch, can't get out. Okay? If you read the law in a black and white fashion, cow stays there until sundown. Well, that cow may die. And if this is your livelihood, that's a huge loss. God extends mercy, and he says, no, if your animal gets in trouble, now you need to make sure on Friday it's in a safe pen, it's where it needs to be, and all those sort of things. But nonetheless, if it manages to get out, he says, go take care of it, and then come back, keep the Sabbath. That's mercy. And walk humbly with your God comes back to this teachability aspect of what God was showing Job. You know something, but you don't know everything. And when you realize you don't know everything, then you can be taught. Because if you try to teach somebody who knows everything, you can't teach them. Let's conclude by going back sort of to where we started. Hebrews 3. Started in Hebrews 2, and I want to finish a thought here as we wrap this up. Hebrews 3, and we'll begin in verse 7. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says, today, if you will hear his voice, in the example of what we're covering today, if you will look at God's creation and see him and then listen to his instruction, which is what we do on this Sabbath, we come before him to hear his instruction. Do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. You know, Israel, when they came out of Egypt, how long did it take them to go into rebellion? It's sad how quickly it happened. But that's carnal nature. He says, in the day of trial in the wilderness where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with that generation, and I said, they will always go astray in their heart, as they have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter into my rest. Now, the rest, in part for them, was to go into the promised land. He promised them a life that was abundant, a land flowing with milk and honey. It had everything it needed, they needed, to sustain them, to provide for them, to be a blessing to them. But more importantly, that day of rest is today. How many people even know what the Sabbath means? How many people know that the Sabbath should be kept that don't keep the Sabbath? How many people keep the Sabbath and they don't keep it right? You know, so we can go through all these levels here. We can say, well, we know, but do we? Do we do it the way God wants us to do it? God says, if you try to do it your own way, you'll not enter into my rest. And that rest he's talking about even goes beyond the Sabbath. It goes to being in his family. What kind of rest would it be to be spirit, truly spirit? How much time do you spend taking care of your physical needs? Washing clothes, shopping for food, cooking food, cleaning your house, taking care of your car. You know, many of the things Mr. Schmidt talked about. What could you do if you didn't have to sleep? And say, if you can't sleep, that's a different story. But if you didn't have to sleep, you know, there's at least, what, 6, 7, 8 hours right there. What could you do with that? What could you do with the time you had if you didn't have to eat? You know, I just fed you yesterday. You want to eat again? You know, we do it every day. Look at all the time we spend with these things. What will we do in God's family? I have no clue what God has in mind. But it's going to be awesome because you're never going to be tired, never going to be hungry, never going to be sore, you're never going to be despondent. You know, all these things that we deal with in this life, we're going to be beyond that. That's the rest he's talking about. Verse 12, beware, brethren, lest there be any of you of an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. How many people lived and knew this way of life, in some cases for decades, and then something happened. They got a hair across their back and they walked away. And now, if you try to talk to them about holy days, Sabbath day, tithing, any of these things, even if they remember it, in most cases, they're angry about it. Wasted time, wasted effort, it was a lie, whatever. But verse 13, exhort one another daily while it is called today. Make the most of the time we have now, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. God has an amazing future in store for all of mankind. He gives us glimpses of what he does to care for us, even in the natural world around us. He has surrounded us with such an amazing creation in the desire that we will learn more about him. On this Sabbath day, then, God's day, let us be reminded of what God is looking for in each one of us, and may we learn from the ant.